currently. It's a nice morning. Wind from the west at 5. We have sunshine, 72 degrees Kenosha, 71 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 7, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm holding in my hands a book that is truly out of the ordinary, and I'm so excited to be able to speak with its author. The book is Get Me Through the Next 5 Minutes, Odes to Being Alive. Let me make sure you catch that subtitle, Odes, O-D-E-S, Odes to Being Alive. It is the work of James Parker, a staff writer for The Atlantic. And if, like me, you are a regular reader of The Atlantic, then you have surely seen his work and have enjoyed, I'm sure, these odes that have been an important part of what he has contributed to The Atlantic for some time. And these odes are basically an exercise in gratitude, in appreciating maybe various assets or aspects of our personal lives, the world around us, that sometimes are missed. And it's not just the things that, you know, come most obviously to mind, you know, ode to a pretty cloud or ode to a rainbow or ode to my grandmother's cookies, but in many cases, calling for us to be grateful for and appreciative of matters of human life, the human experience that maybe we don't often think of in terms of gratitude, things like insomnia or middle age or rushing about or the pandemic. He is really, that is the author, James Parker, is enlarging our sense of what gratitude is all about and for what we should be grateful. The book is published by W.W. Norton and Company. And James Parker, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. And right now, I'm grateful for that beautiful intro. I mean, you explained it in such a wonderful way. So thank you.
You're very welcome.
Good morning to your listeners as well.
Before we explore this book, I cannot resist the temptation to ask you about something that is mentioned in your biography. I am so anxious to know more about the Black Seed Writers Group, which we're told is a weekly writing workshop for homeless, transitional, and recently housed writers. Please tell us more about this group and what this experience has been like for you over the last more than a decade.
Thank you. Thank you for asking that. I love talking about the Black Seed Writers. So we started in 2011, end of 2011. And it's a weekly space. It's a weekly place to write. That's how we sell it to the writers. We say it's not therapy, it's not a ministry, it's not social work, it's not a classroom. It's a space to write, and it's in the basement of the Cathedral Church of St. Paul in downtown Boston, which is right by Boston Common. So there's a lot of people living, you know, in and around that area on the street, or have connections to the street. So they come in, the writers come in, and it runs from 9:30 to 10:45 every Tuesday morning. And what gets written in the space, we then type up and we print it out and we give it back to the writers the following week. And we have a magazine called The Pilgrim, which we publish about every 4 or 5 months whenever we can manage it. And it's a very beautiful publication. You can look us up on thepilgrim.org. And it's just been a, I mean, I had the sensation when I started that I just flicked. I'd flicked a switch, you know, and this incredible current was now pouring through, and that sensation has not gone away for the almost 13 years that I've been doing it. So I'm very, very good. I've had a lot of help. My partner is Christy Towers down there. She runs it with me. And the writers themselves, of course, kind of co-create the space. That's how we do it, Greg. Thank you for asking.
Can you explain in what way it is a workshop? I mean, what is sort of the interaction that occurs between you and your partner and these writers?
So they come in, and there's coffee, and sometimes there's a bit of food, and there's pens and paper, and there's the writing from the week before, which is a very good way for a new writer to kind of acquaint him or herself with the vibe of the space, to read what was written down there the week before. And then there's the prompt sheet, where I give him a few prompts, a few ideas. The very, very first prompt that I ever gave the Black Seed Writers Group was "The Last Time I Was Happy." And at the time, I remember thinking, oh, is this a bit like, a bit sort of near the knuckle, but it was actually they really got into it, and they wrote some amazing stuff. So people sit there and write, or they don't write, or they drink their coffee, or they chat with each other, or maybe if they're indisposed to write for whatever reason, we might transcribe what they say and write that down, and then that will get printed up. So there's all sorts of ways of kind of getting the writing out of people. And, you know, some people are very productive. Some people come once every 2 years. I mean, one of the nice things about having gone on for so long is that we've been able to kind of absorb a lot of cycles in these guys' lives. Do you know what I mean? They might go to hospital. They might go to jail. They might just leave the city for a bit. They might just shift their territory for a bit, or have a change of life or a change of lifestyle. And then they might come back. And it's incredibly rewarding to see them again after they've been away. So it's a kind of a floating sort of guild of writers. I mean, hundreds of people have come through the group at this point, and they're all over the country too. So people write in, people send us stuff. So yeah, that's the, I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, I think largely, is there any aspect of this that is in effect about making a given person's writing better? Or is that not really a significant part of the purpose of this? Is it simply to give people this priceless opportunity to write and have whatever they have written embraced and appreciated?
That's nearer the mark, what you just said. I mean that's a very good question. Better is not really the point. More itself is the point. Like if we feel like we're getting the writer, because people have all sorts of blocks, as you know, about writing, and all sorts of insecurities and inferiorities about picking up a pen and saying stuff. So if we can get the writer through those things and into what he or she wants to express. It's not really about, you know, is this fantastic? Many times it is fantastic writing because it's so direct and it's so raw. But it's not really about that. It's more about what, you know, can we help them say what they need to say?
A last question. Can you recall what specifically prompted you to launch this back in 2011?
Yes, I mean, I should say it's part of a larger program down there called the Manor Ministry. So we're just one facet of this thing. But this is, you know, this is our little baby, the Writers Group. And I remember walking across Boston Common in early 2011 with my friend Susan, and we were saying, God, you know, life is all right, but it's a bit boring, isn't it? Shouldn't we just do something? And she said, I know this priest. You know, she's running this thing. I think we should volunteer down there. So we volunteered. And then I had the idea for the writers group, and that was the beginning. A kind of restlessness. I've always had an interest in you know, marginal writing, you know, testimony from the kind of fringes of things. And so I feel like it was kind of meant to be in a way.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with James Parker, a staff writer for The Atlantic, and we're about to begin talking about a book of his which has just been published called "Get Me Through the Next 5 Minutes: Odes to Being Alive," a collection of the odes. Again, that's ODES, the odes that he has written for The Atlantic, which have been now a cherished part of that publication for some time. Actually, ahead of us delving into that book and the story behind these odes, I wonder if you would mind just telling us a little bit about your own introduction to the joys and satisfaction of writing. Was this an important part of your life from very early on?
Oh, yes, very, very much, Greg. Yeah, I always knew I was going to be a writer. I just didn't know what I was going to write, and it took me a long time. My 20s and early 30s were fairly sort of chaotic. All of which I'm very, very grateful for now, because I had some very interesting experiences, and a lot of stuff that kind of made me who I am as a writer. I remember when I first got the job at the Atlantic, I was talking to one of the established writers there, and he was saying that there's a huge gap in your resume here. Like, what, you went to college and then there's just sort of blank for like 15 years. And I said, well, yeah, because I was crashing around. I had different jobs in different places. I traveled around America. I did some things. It wasn't organized and it wasn't easy at all. In fact, it was very difficult sometimes, but I always had the sense that at some point I was going to be able to turn all these experiences into writing. I feel like that's what I'm beginning to do with this book, happily.
When did you begin at the Atlantic?
About, I think it's almost 15 years ago.
Mm.
I wrote them, I think, for 2.5 years. There's now a crossword in the space where I used to do the odes. But the odes in this book, some of them were published in the Atlantic, but there's a lot of new stuff because I've gone in some slightly weirder and more personal directions with the form that I was lucky enough to be gifted and to discover at the Atlantic with my editor John Swansburg.
Mm. So yes, you were approached. You tell us in the introduction to the book, you were approached by the editors at the Atlantic that you should begin writing something that would be kind of a regular feature, perhaps in the inside back page of the magazine. Talk about what your first efforts were and actually what the first few efforts were called before eventually somebody came to you with the idea of writing odes very specifically.
Right. I had lunch with the editors and they're like, we're going to give you this space, but we want something at the back of the magazine that's going to have a little sort of pop to it, and leave readers feeling okay, and just a little kind of entertainment, just to sort of send them on their way cheerfully out the back of the magazine, out the back door. Do you know what I mean? So I experimented. So my first idea was let's call it the riff. I'll just riff. And I had this idea that I was just going to go off kind of wildly about something quite small. It could be a guitar solo or a line of poetry or a scene in a movie or something like that. So I tried a couple of them and they didn't really fly. Then I said, why don't we call it the zoom in? And I'll just zoom in on like a moment of culture, something like a hot mic moment that some politician has. Or something that I see is very significant that nobody else has really noticed. I'll zoom in, and I'll try that, and that didn't really work. So then my editor John Swansburg said, "Why don't we call them odes?" And at first I wasn't quite sure because I don't actually like the word ode very much. It's as a word, I love what they are now, but ode, I just couldn't really hang my thoughts on it. But actually, very quickly, it became clear what they were, they sort of taught me themselves what they wanted to be. And I think they had kind of a good effect on my style as well. They encouraged me to be a bit more direct, and slightly shorter sentences, just a little less kind of baroque in the way that I express things, which is a bit of a vice of mine. I get quite carried away just with language. That's how it happened, and as we worked on them, their nature kind of announced itself ever more clearly. Although right till the end, we were still you know, wondering, is this an ode? Is that an ode? What is an ode? How do you know? How did, does this work? Does that work? I mean, there's plenty of kind of misfires in the files. So that's kind of how it happened.
It might be good for just a moment to talk a little bit about what that term, at least typically and historically, has represented. And you actually spend a little time in the book's introduction talking about some noteworthy authors of odes. I mean, and you know, given the fact that you're perhaps not adhering with terrible strictness to whatever definition is most proper, that's not a bad place for us to begin with what, in general, an ode typically is.
Quite right. So odes typically are poems. And the man who's credited with inventing the ode is Pindar in ancient Greece, you know, something 100 BC. And his odes were in praise of athletes, great feats of athleticism, charioteers and wrestlers and boxers and runners. Those were the first odes. So in my book, whenever I get close to, I write about soccer in there a bit. I write about going to the UFC event in Vegas. Whenever I get near that stuff, I feel like I'm writing the, you know, the ancient stream of odeness. And then there was Horace, of course, Horace the Roman, who wrote some very famous odes. Seize the day, you know, all that stuff. And then you know, Keats wrote some beautiful odes. Pablo Neruda, the Chilean poet, he was kind of a model of mine because he wrote hundreds of odes in a very sort of slapdash. You know, he was obviously hugely talented, so it worked even when he was being slapdash. But very, very random in his and broad in his subject matter. You know, ode to fish soup, ode to my socks, ode to this politician, ode to that newspaper, ode to the noise I can hear in the next door bedroom, blah blah blah. So there's the kind of unsung odes, the odes that don't necessarily present themselves as odes, which I think are just moments in writing when reality kind of expands a little bit under the attention of the author, and you can just feel yourself slipping into a slightly heightened mode of perception. And you can find them anywhere. You know, I love Nicholson Baker, the writer. I think he's full of them. So my odes, some of them are poems, most of them are little kind of micro essays. Some of them vaguely resemble journalism, but they all I hope partake of the same kind of mission, which is to, you know, get under the skin of things and praise reality.
You made mention of something like, you know, having a drawer full of misfires. And I'm just curious, when you are sitting down and attempting to write an ode, what would be kind of a typical example of an ode that ends up in your drawer because it doesn't become what you want it to be?
I keep trying to write an ode to repetition. I still think there's an ode there, but I just can't quite seem to find the angle. It's to do with how things get some things get better and more powerful the more times they happen. I mean, you know, I'm a Catholic, so I go to Mass when I get it together, and you know, liturgy is like that. You know, the same words repeated over again. I'm also a huge fan of heavy metal, and my, you know, my favorite moments in metal tend to be big riffs that repeat and repeat and repeat and somehow put on power and magnify as they do so. In one's day, you know, one has one's rituals, one has one's repetitions, and they too can take on a very, very almost transcendent kind of value, you know, just because you keep doing it and you've kept doing it and you've been doing it for a long time. I mean, my writers group is a little bit like that. You know, we've done it for so long that just the sheer fact that we show up and do it again gives it a special kind of power. So, I mean, it sounds like I just wrote an ode there, but for some reason I can't make it work. But actually, having said all that, I think maybe I'll give it another shot.
There you go. I'll have to send you the link to this interview so you can listen to yourself again. I suppose, you know, one of the things you're touching on is something that I said in the introduction, which is your odes, generally speaking, tend not to be about you know, Ode to a Pretty Flower or Ode to, you know, having a grandchild. I mean, the kind of things about which people, generally speaking at least, are easily, effortlessly, naturally grateful for. And you're talking about, in many cases, composing odes to things that would, you know, otherwise probably never occur to us to honor in this way. Something like, for instance, procrastination. How about if we begin with your ode to procrastination? But maybe even ahead of delving very specifically there, how do these ideas come to you? That is, when you are writing an ode to something that arguably has never had an ode written about it ever before.
Well, there's, you know, there's a nice sort of spark just to being a little bit counterintuitive about it to begin with. You know what I mean? Like what can I find? You know, I'm a writer, so I sit on my own, you know, stewing and fretting and, you know, taking miserable naps and procrastinating and, you know, doing all the things that a writer does. So there are a lot of, you know, states that I mean, everybody has these states or their own version of them. There are a lot of states that I pass through that aren't necessarily that, you know, that great. So it's interesting to take a, you know, take a deeper look and try and, you know, try and find the positive, not in, as you say, I hope, a kind of like a twee or a trite way. I mean, as you're talking about the fluffy clouds, there's a series of books for kids in England that we all used to read at school, called Back in the Jug Again, and there was they were all written in the voice of a schoolboy called Nigel Molesworth, and it was all spelt very badly. But there's a character in there called Fotherington Thomas, and who is despised by Molesworth, the narrator, because all he does is skip about in a wonderful mood, going, "Hello clouds, hello sky," you know. So I was always hoping that I could avoid that. You know, I don't just want to be flinging, you know, sort of superficial praises around. But I like, you know, if I can get into something. And yeah, I mean, procrastination is a very interesting state. I mean, all sorts of things happen when you're procrastinating. You put off one thing, but you find yourself, you know, magically empowered and energized to do another thing. You know, you might clean up your house, for example, when you should be writing a piece. Or you know, you should be shopping for somebody's birthday present, but instead you cook a fantastic meal for yourself or something. And there's a different phases of procrastination, and then the moment when finally it becomes too unbearable and you're actually impelled to do the thing, and then you discover that it actually took much less time than you imagined. You know, so the ode is sort of about that. It's just really great about just thinking about things and just paying them some attention and seeing what is revealed.
I really love that, and maybe as a award-winning procrastinator myself, I especially appreciated this ode. Do you mind if I read just a little bit of this ode for our listeners?
I would love it. I'd be very appreciative of that. Thank you.
So it opens this way, and I'm going to leave one phrase out that should not be over the air, but otherwise it opens this way. So this is Ode to Procrastination. Mysterious state. More passive than active. When you're procrastinating, stalling, temporizing, it envelops you. You are consumed by the thing you're not doing, the commitment you're resisting. It niggles in your brain. It itches in your body. As for your soul, some kind of invisible celestial countdown is going on somewhere. Tick, tick, tick. I just love that because, I mean, for most of us, we don't take the time to think about what procrastination is, and we think of it as, you know, kind of a blank slate of doing nothing, and that's simply not true. And
well, yeah, I mean, that was beautifully read, Greg. Thank you. But I mean, think about the privilege of me as a writer on a deadline. You know, that's being encouraged to think about procrastination. I mean, I think that's why that one worked so well.
Absolutely.
I was living it as I was writing it, you know.
Sure. You go on to say describe one aspect of procrastination that I think is really brilliant. And this is, I think, is at the heart of what we misunderstand. Outwardly, when I'm procrastinating, I'm at my ease. I'm pottering about, I'm picking up books and putting them down again, I'm chatting gaily on the phone, I'm eating barbecue chips. But inwardly, I'm in violent Luciferian rebellion against the angels of adulthood, of responsibility, of unfreedom. I'm clenched. I'm sulfurous. I brood with fiery pinions. I won't go to the bloody bank. I won't go to the post office. I might not shave. Expecting something from me, feedback, a prompt reply, a timely handling of something or other. Good luck. I mean, that duality of what it looks like on the outside versus the turmoil on the inside.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, only if you're a procrastinator could you possibly understand the reality of that.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I hope, that's the other thing. I tried to pick things that people could relate to, you know, because as much as you or I or, you know, any writer out there might feel wildly kind of out on a limb with how they're feeling, I think we're not really that different, any of us. And my, you know, it's kind of my sort of chief article of faith as a writer. Like if I'm feeling it, then probably a lot of other people are too. I hope that's the case. Anyway.
Absolutely. Well, of course, your ode goes on to say that there's not only this inward-outward duality, two faces to procrastination, but it's also not the same thing over time. There's different phases to procrastination. So what I just read, that's phase one, clinically interesting but no fun. Sloth, like every sin worth its name, disquiets me and divides me from myself. And the early stage of procrastination is suffused with sloth. You go on to say the horizon brightens, however, in phase two. In phase two, you get busy. Vats of energy are suddenly available to you, straining to avoid that one particular thing, dawdling mightily. You can do five other things. You can clean the house. You can work out. You can write a book, the wrong book, but still a book. If you organize yourself skillfully, you can be productive and even sort of professional precisely while you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. My friend Josh calls this the virtuous circle of procrastination. I have to admit to having never really ever thought about that, but this phase two, it's maybe one reason why some of us get kind of hooked on procrastination because of this energy inside of us.
Yeah, exactly. There is energy in there because you're suppressing your own energy, so it's got to come out somewhere. So suddenly you're like, well, I'll fire off 10 emails. You know, I'll you know, you have a kind of paroxysm of efficiency. Greg, I hope I'm not sounding too awful laughing at my own material, but it's such a pleasure. It's such a pleasure hearing you read it. That's all. I'm just enjoying it so much. So thank
you. I should think you have every reason to enjoy your own work, and especially when it's done so well. And of course, we shouldn't leave people hanging. There is a third phase to procrastination.
Oh, yes.
This is how the ode ends. In phase three, it ends. It has to. Strangely built into the procrastinatory moment, however long it lasts, is the consciousness that eventually, finally, you are going to do this thing. You may have dallied with magical thinking. Perhaps they'll forget about it. Perhaps somebody else will do it. But you know there's no way out. It's going to happen. So bring on the Red Bull. Bring on the Slayer, the deadline, the freakout, and the perspiration, whatever it takes. Sometimes all it takes is literally 45 seconds of sustained attention. How about that? And now it's over. You've emerged. You've been playing with time like a weird little god, stretching it and inspecting it, and you'll do it again, procrastinator. You know you will, until there's no more time to play with. That is Ode to Procrastination from James Parker's Get Me Through the Next 5 Minutes, Odes to Being Alive. So, in a sense, I guess I'm curious. I mean, you said all of this about procrastination. Is it that you want us to feel better about procrastination? Or is there some other purpose behind this particular piece?
No, I think it's what you said. I would love it if people felt better about procrastinating. I would love it if they could have the self-awareness not to castigate themselves too mightily, and not to beat themselves up too much. You know, we're awful at that. We say terrible things to ourselves when we're in these conditions. and they do pass, and you do your thing. And if you can accept, in a way, that it's all part of the process, as bizarre as that might seem, and try and embrace the bits of you, the kind of laggard, shadowy bits of you that really don't want to, you know, be functional at all. Yes, I hope. This does sound trite, but I really would like to make people feel better. I mean, that would be lovely. That's a very honorable aim in my book.
Well, and it seems like we're talking about two things there as well. That is, maybe for someone who is a procrastinator to feel less guilt or regret about that. And the other thing is for people in our lives who are not procrastinators to maybe look at us with maybe a little more sympathy, even some envy. I don't know, but there's a couple of different ways that can play out, depending on who you are.
Yes, not be quite as impatient with us, you know, just to understand that we're going through this rather majestic and really very, very fascinating sort of journey that we're on. Yeah, that would be nice.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with James Parker, and we're talking about his book, Get Me Through the Next 5 Minutes, Odes to Being Alive. And the book is a collection of various odes that James Parker has written. Many of them, I'm guessing maybe most of them, have appeared in Atlantic Monthly, but some of them have been published in other places. Perhaps some of them have only appeared in the pages of this particular book. Before we explore a couple of other specific odes, it's so interesting to just read down this list. I don't want to take the time to read all of them, and I did not take the time to count them all. Do you happen to know how many odes we're talking about?
I think there's about like 62 or something like that. For some reason, that's the number in my head.
At a glance, that looks about right. And I'm just going to read a portion of that list from the table of contents, just to give our listeners a rough idea of just how expansive the ground is that you cover. So we have Ode to Barbecue Chips, Ode to the Left Hand, Ode to Insomnia, Ode to Being Dead, Ode to Middle Age, Ode to Not Meditating, Ode to Getting It Wrong, Ode to Constipation, Ode to Small Talk, Ode to Bad Reviews, Ode to Squirrels, Ode to Naps, Ode to My Thesaurus, Ode to Running in Movies, Ode to Cold Showers, and on it goes. I'm just curious, as you said about putting this book together, did you look at the list of odes and think, oh, I've left out any mention of such and such? Or did you want it to be just kind of this crazy quilt of a whole lot of different things with, in a sense, not a lot of rhyme or reason in terms of which odes would be part of this book?
Exactly what you said there, Greg. I want it to be as scattershot and as random feeling and as unexpected, you know, going from one to the next. Even formally, you know, like you might go from a nice chunk of prose to a very short little poem, or a slightly longer poem, or a very short piece of prose. So I want it to be a sort of a jump cut thing. And part of my, you know, my sort of mission, if it's not too grand, is to encourage people to you know, write their own odes, or at least try and identify the odes that are presenting themselves to them. And you know, odes are everywhere, surrounding us, you know, clamoring for our attention. So if just reading down that list kind of, you know, stimulates that kind of sense of the world and its variety. I'm sounding very grand here, I apologize. The world and its variety, I'm very happy with the table of contents. I think that's almost like an ode in itself, in a weird way. just to read down it like you just did.
So, absolutely.
I hope that answers your question.
Sure. I think I started with Ode to Procrastination because I thought that was a really good example of something that we don't necessarily think of when we think of things to honor or things to be grateful for or things that are wonderful in our lives. And there are certain things that you write about that are even more in that direction. Things that we often think of only as unpleasantries, if that's a word. I mean, things that are a source of frustration, even anger.
Yep.
I mean, things that make us want to scream. For instance, there is here an ode to crying babies. I'm curious to know what prompted you to sit down and write about crying babies in this way.
I start the ode with a baby crying on a plane, you know, a few rows ahead of me. I mean, if you've ever flown, then you've had that experience. And the piercing nature of the baby's cry, and what it does to the body, even of somebody who's not actually related to that, because what it's doing to the mother's body is very intense. I mean, there are all sorts of neurochemical things going on while the baby's crying, and for the dad too, but to a lesser extent, I think. But even if you're just, even if you don't know the baby, if you can't see the baby, you can just hear it. Something happens. It's a kind of a primal thing. And you know, my son, he's 22 now, but the sound of him crying is kind of installed in my nervous system somewhere. So it's about this kind of like protest that the baby is making at the conditions of life, which is so impressive. It's such an incredibly powerful protest. And the baby is so tiny, but the effect it's having on its environment with this noise is so potent. That's what that ode is about. It's quite short.
Yes.
But
would you mind if I read it, or would you like to read it for our listeners?
Oh, if I could read it, could I read it? Great.
Sure, absolutely.
Let me just find it. One second.
So this is Ode to Crying Babies. It's page 50. In case you don't have your own book completely memorized cover to cover. And again, we're hearing from James Parker. He's about to read from his book, Get Me Through the Next 5 Minutes, Odes to Being Alive.
Here we go, Greg. I've got Ode to Crying Babies. Okay. Ode to Crying Babies. Crying baby, I hear you. I've got no choice but to hear you. You're 10 rows ahead of me in economy, raging like Lear on the heath. Blow winds and crack your cheeks. You're challenging the gods, the elements, the injustice of life. You may also have gas. Who is by your side as you arraign the universal order? Who is with you at this ultimate moment? Lear had his fool, and you have your parents. Pale, stretched, stooping presences. They loom over you uncertainly, exhaustedly. Most horrible, with the last of their energy, they bicker. Even as they attend to you, they're saying quietly vile things to each other. If they get divorced, crying baby, it's your fault. But listen, I appreciate you. I appreciate your outspokenness, your indignation. These bodies that we're in, they're not always the greatest, are they? They itch, they sting, they ache, they bloat, they overheat, they feel weird, they get tired, they make us grumpy, which is, now I think about it, another thing I appreciate about you. With you, the rusty old mind-body binary does not apply. Your pure mood or pure biology, your digestive system and your emotional life are basically the same thing. My own days as a crying baby, I have forgotten. How does that happen? Where do we stash those great seasons of rage, those unmatched ego flights? But I do remember when I lived with one. He's 21 now. The bitter clarion of his voice in the night would rouse me like an electric shock. Anyway, keep it up, little tyrant. These crescendos, these arcs of noise, these cluckings, incensed silences, and long shivering notes. You've got a lot of power, and you've got no power at all. You're a tiny fist shaking at the heavens. Soon you'll be talking, and language will betray you. You'll utter vague, helpless half sentences. You'll make bad jokes. But right now, your voice is very direct, very effective. It's going right through my head.
That was Ode to Crying Babies by James Parker. I really, really love that. And I'm just curious to know, do you recall kind of your thought process in terms of coming to this remarkable understanding and, in a sense, acceptance of a crying baby on a crowded airplane flight? I assume that did not occur to you in an instant.
No, it didn't. But this is the wonderful thing about writing, I think, Greg. I mean, I think writing leads, you know, like one's writing self is a little bit more intelligent and a lot more empathetic than one's day-to-day regular self, I think. So if you can give yourself over to it, it will kind of lead you in the direction of some depth. And once you're in the dimension of depth, then all sorts of things can be occurring to you, and they come at you. It's not like I'm coming up with these ideas; they come at me. That feels like how it works anyway.
Absolutely. One ode that maybe we won't take the time to read in its entirety, although not because it isn't really, really interesting, but just because our time is getting away from us, is Ode to Taking It Seriously. And this is a really intriguing ode in which you begin by talking to us about what you're like as a drummer and your shortcomings as a drummer. But then you go on to kind of frame this in a little different way. Just talk us briefly through Ode to Taking It Seriously. It's an interesting journey on which you take us.
Well, the seed of it, I think, or the germ of it, came about when I was writing for a paper called the Boston Phoenix a long time ago, and they sent me on a story to report on some Revolutionary War reenactors. And I went to a reenacted battle in Hubbardton, Vermont, with these Revel War reenactors. And they talk about taking it seriously. I mean, they were, you know, right down to the buttons and the buckles on the boots and the type of, you know, everything to do with the musketry and the food and all, everything. I mean, like an intense attention and devotion to detail. And at one point, I said to one of these guys after he'd been sort of ranting away about you know, something that was to me very, very kind of arcane, but very important to him in terms of getting it right. I said, "Aren't you taking all this a little bit seriously?" And he looked at me and he said, "Listen, the more seriously you take it, the more fun it is." And that absolutely, you know, my third eye just like popped open because I think that's real wisdom. If you really apply yourself to something, especially something that seems a bit recreational, then you discover things and things will be given to you and sort of delivered to you in a way that doesn't happen if you're just kind of mucking about. Mucking about has its own value, of course, but if you can apply yourself if you practice hard and if you work on something and you try and get it right and you try and get it as close as possible to what you want and don't give up too early, then you will be rewarded. I think that's just the law of physics, basically.
Absolutely.
So I think that's what this ode is about, Greg. I mean, do you agree?
I do. I love it. And my full-time job's as a music professor, as a voice teacher, and this spoke to me.
Wow.
This spoke to me very, very directly. I'm just going to read a couple of lines. So this friend that you were talking to, he looked at me with the transparency of the Dalai Lama. The more seriously you take it, he said, the more fun it is. So with life, so with being in a band, an earnest commitment at ground level gets you access to the higher playfulness. And you go on to say, if you practice enough, you can stop thinking, which is bliss.
Yeah, that's
in
it.
The heart of the noise, there's a silent click of abandonment, and you're away. And I think that's something for anybody outside of the world of music can't possibly understand, how in the hard work of rehearsal, you are setting the stage then for the wonderful joy of performance, which
because I think, you know, we all want that moment. We all want to stop thinking and just get carried along. But it takes it takes conscious preparation, doesn't it? That's the paradox.
Absolutely. The last ode we have time to talk about, might surprise you that this jumped out at me, but it's Ode to Advice Columns. It's maybe because I've become addicted to a podcast, one aspect of Slate's podcast called Vulture, where once in a while we hear from their advice columnist, Dear Prudence. And tomorrow I'm recording an interview with advice columnist Amy Dickinson before she retires from the Chicago Tribune.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so this is very much on my mind, the allure of advice columns. And you tell us right off the bat, you will never, ever write into an advice column because you're too busy reading them. You say, yeah. I read them and I read them. You call yourself, in a sense, kind of a peeping Tom. But then you go on to explain why you think there is such an intriguing allure to the advice column. And it's, in a sense, the timelessness of them. Just say a word about this, if you would.
I think it's the idea that somebody can solve our problems, isn't it? Like we're like, you know, there's the it struck me that it's not unrelated to comedy, the structure of it. There's a setup or stand-up comedy I'm talking about, in that there's a tension produced by the kind of posing of the problem and the telling of the story, and then, you know, in a different font down below, there's the answer, which is sort of like the punchline, or at least there's a kind of release of anxiety in reading the answer. So there's something about the mechanism itself of these columns which just hooks you on a sort of metabolic, you know, little cellular level, I suppose. But then it's the idea that people actually know the answers to these problems, which nobody does. I mean, of course, there's such a thing as good advice, and I'm sure. People have been advised and have been helped by these columns, but it's based on a kind of lovely fantasy that somebody actually knows what to do somewhere. Someone somewhere knows what to do. So there's also something basically kind of voyeuristic about reading about other people's problems. I think that too is just a very, you know, human reaction. We're just like apes just sort of watching each other, like, what's happening now? What's going on?
Right, exactly. So, and of course, you say part of it too is that the problems are the same now and forever. Yeah. This is the point. Yeah. This is who we are. The same dilemmas, the same misunderstandings. My boss is a pig. Why won't my stepdaughter say thank you? I married a frog. I thought you were a prince, and so on. And then you go on to say, and the problem of all problems, the old chestnut, why am I doing what I'm doing when it's so obviously bad for me, my health, my family, the world? St. Paul put this one best in his letter to the Romans. For what I would, that I do not, but what I hate, that I do. And, of course, the experience of having some of those age-old conundrums perhaps solved for the moment in an advice column is part of what draws us back. So are there going to be more odes flowing from your pen in the future?
Do you know what? I think there have to be, because since I sort of stopped, or at least finished this book, I haven't written any odes since I finished this book, I've found myself getting a lot more grumpy in everyday life, because I think, you know, many of these odes are actually addressed to me, you know, like reminding myself and encouraging myself to enjoy things and take the time and look deeply. So they're a very good, they're a very helpful exercise for me. So that alone, whether they ever get published or not, that will impel me to write some more, I think.
Right. I'm reminded of words I saw on a plaque. I have no idea who wrote these words, but I've remembered them 30 years now. If we pause to think, we will have cause to thank. And I feel like your book is a marvelous exercise in exactly that. The book, again, is Get Me Through the Next 5 Minutes, Odes to Being Alive, published by W.W. Norton & Company, the author James Parker. James Parker, what a pleasure to explore your wonderful book and to speak with you about it on The Morning Show. I hope we get to talk again. And in the meantime, best wishes to you.
I hope so, Greg. Yeah, thank you. It was so nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, our good friend Dr. Art Sear pays his monthly visit to the program. And on Wednesday, David Lapp, one of the founders of the National Organization Braver Angels. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Sunny today and a high of 83 degrees inland, cooler near the lake. Some clouds rolling in overnight with a 70% chance of rain. Some of that rain could be heavy. Overnight low of 73. Sunny tomorrow and hot, warming to a high of 91 degrees, heat index close to 96. Nicer on Wednesday, sunny and a high of 79. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News and classical music on your gateway to